celebrate St. Patrick's Day now, but it wasn't always so easy for the Irish who came to America.
Those who actually immigrated, you know, they had to get on with the business of surviving, you know, going from rural poverty to urban poverty and being hated for being Irish Catholic. And, you know, the nativist movement was very strong. And so that generation, they were known as the Silent People.
That's Cynthia Neal. We'll talk with her about her novel, Nora, The Making of an Irish-American Woman in 19th Century New York. And Kevin O'Hara's immigrant parents used religion to help keep the traditions of the old country alive for their children.
My father said the Hails and we said the Holies, and you really had to keep on the ball because, you know, you'd lull to sleep with the mantra of the prayer, more or less, and plus you had a million other things on your mind. And he'd stop suddenly dead, and then he'd ask us how many Hail Marys were left.
He tells what it was like to grow up Irish in America. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Tis the week of St. Patrick's Day. What is it about this ethnic and religious festival that makes it so beloved, even among Americans who are neither Irish nor Catholic? It must be more than the green beer. My guest, Cynthia Neal, thinks it has something to do with what the Irish can teach the world about surviving hardship, armed with nothing but the indomitable human spirit. That's because America didn't always treat the Irish who settled here as honored Americans. Fleeing the Great Potato Famine of 1846 to 1852, known to the Irish as An Gairte Mór, they streamed into New York. What they left behind, in the words of one writer, was a calm, still horror. But the clamor of the New World brought horrors of its own. During the 1850s, the Irish in America were treated with scorn. One immigrant wrote home, "Our position in America is one of shame and poverty." When they looked for work, they confronted signs saying, "No Irish need apply." Some 80% of all infants born to Irish immigrants in New York City died. This is the setting in which my guest Cynthia Neal sets her protagonist, Nora McCabe. In two earlier novels, for children, she followed Nora from Ireland during the time of the Great Hunger to New York City. By the time we meet her in this third novel, written for adults, Nora McCabe has pulled herself up by her scrappy bootstraps to become a journalist and then a fighter for the Irish struggle for independence. Cynthia Neal, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's great to be on your program.
This was the first book I think I've ever read about an Irish woman in America in the 19th century, and I really found it fascinating. You must have done quite a bit of research for this book.
I did. I did quite a bit, and it carried through from my research I did for the first book, The Irish Dresser, and the second book, Hope in New York City. So I had, of course, you know, all the research a writer does of historical fiction. You can't use all that research, and it's hard to part with it. But for my sake, for this book, I was able to go into that and use it for the third book. And it's always great to have primary sources, and I research like crazy. I went to the New York Public Library, and I take copious notes and organize them, and after I feel that I have done enough research, like I'm living right in that period, then I start writing, and not before, even though the character's been with me for a while.
So you mentioned two other books. This is the first one for adults. The others were The Irish Dresser and Hope in New York City. Those were for young adults?
Yes, they are. Yeah, the first one takes primarily... the setting is primarily in Ireland, and it's during the Great Hunger and An Gairte Mór, 1845 to 1850. And I don't candy coat the truth about what really happened during this time. It really was a political famine, even though the loss of the potato crop was real, of course. But the family leaves Ireland and eventually comes to America, and she has an adventure on the ship. So mostly it does take place in Ireland. The second book is, it's like the middle child is that, you know, who has gotten lost in the middle, because there's a lot of history in the second book, and it does take place in New York City as well. And that came out a couple years later, and then Nora came out a year ago.
So that's interesting, because I kind of wondered, I mean, there was a lot of backshadowing, maybe you call it, reference to earlier things that had happened, but I've really felt that this book stood alone. But I did want to ask you about the famine. Give us the background to this. The famine is almost like a character in some ways in this book, because when it's referred to, it's clear that there has been such a trauma. So orient us. What was the impact of the famine on the Irish who fled it and came to America?
Well, you know, it was a country of 8.5 million people, and you had most of them, you had three-quarters of them who were dependent on the potatoes, a monocultural society, and of course, most people would understand that it was a colony of Great Britain, and, you know, they had wanted their freedom from Great Britain, of course, and there was 700 plus years of conquering and subjugation and dominion. And over a period of time, with the division of land and really overpopulation, they became so dependent on the potato. And then when this fungus destroyed the potato, I mean, they had smaller famines prior to what is known as the, you know, the Great Hunger and Gotamore. And this was the most devastating. Over 1 million people perished, and over 2 million immigrated to North America, and also did step migration, going to England and then coming over or staying in England. And so it was John Mitchell, who was part of the Young Ireland movement. He said a calm, still horror was all over the land, and the Irish were often referred to as the silent people.
What did he call it? I didn't quite catch that.
He said, "A calm, still horror." This is after the Great Hunger, 1845 to 1850, was in Gotamore. He said, "A calm, still horror was all over the land. The Irish were often referred to as the silent people."
And what did he mean by that?
Well, it was so horrific, and there was so much death, and there was so much desperation, that some of the things that happened were, you know, the people were, they ate grass, they ate nettles, you know, they saw their neighbors die. It was just so horrific that those who actually immigrated, you know, they had to get on with the business of surviving, you know, going from rural poverty to urban poverty and being hated for being Irish Catholic. And, you know, the native movement was very strong, and so that generation, they were known as the silent people. And I think that to some degree, you know, this still exists. I did a play in 1997 for a festival, and I sat on a committee, and there were plenty of Irish-born older men who said, "Why would you be bringing this up now for?" And I had been asked to do the play to commemorate the 150 years since the Great Hunger. And so it was it's a very difficult subject to deal with. And, you know, I had people saying to me at the time, "Why would the Irish only want to eat potatoes?" And you'd be surprised how many people who did not understand what really was going on. There was food in Ireland. It was shipped out before their starving eyes. I mean, some of the same attitudes today, you know, about responding to the drought in, you know, in Somalia, it existed then and today. You know, it is just hunger is an issue that I'll always be passionate about. But for many reasons, I wanted to write about this story, and I feel that I was writing about a real person, because after the second book, I found out there was a real Nora McCabe, who came from Ireland in 1847 to New York City. But I think it's an important subject. I think it was William Faulkner who said, "The past is not dead and buried. It is not even past." I think it's important because, you know, we are the sum of our ancestors, and there's, you know, there's ethnic healing through telling these stories.
Wow, that is so powerful what you've said there. And, you know, 150 years after the famine, and people are still so traumatized when they personally didn't even experience it that they didn't want you to talk about it. That's quite striking.
I think so, too. And I, you know, still struggle, you know, being an American, having Irish blood, but meeting, you know, I know a lot of people who were born in Ireland, and I traveled to Ireland, and I think it's better now, but there's still sometimes this, let's not talk about this. It's this attitude that, you know, let's just get on with life. And, it, you know, it's a shame-based culture in some ways, and yet there's such a story that they have given us through that indomitable spirit, because even in my first book, when I researched and I used a journal, and this Protestant minister recorded this journal, Robert White, and he recorded, you know, everything that went on. Of course, these were lumber ships, these were cattle ships, they weren't passenger ships, and there was typhoid, and they were, you know, they were terrible. You know, the most of the people died even before they got to Canada or got to North America. But he recorded, and he saw just how they would still dance, they would still play music. And so when you look at what the small country has given to the world through music, through dance, through literature, I think that is the real, the spirit of the indomitable spirit of getting through suffering and teaching the world how to go through suffering, even today.
And your character, Nora McCabe, I mean, who so embodies this, she's quite an amazing, has an indomitable spirit herself. Before we start talking about her, though, describe the place that they settled in, that they came to, Five Points in New York, which I don't even think exists anymore. Is that right?
No, I don't believe it does. It is Chinatown now, I believe, mm-hmm. from you know, my research and what I've learned. I haven't been there. I just did a lot of research, but I'm told that it is Chinatown today. But it really was it's where the immigrants went. We're not just the Irish, but you had the African Americans were there. You had Germans at the same time that the Irish came. There was an influx of Germans who were in better health. They were coming for political reasons. And they were all put there together. And it was just a time of xenophobia and a fear that the Catholic Church was going to take over, that the Pope was taking over, and so the Protestant aristocrats and some of the newspapers would write about them taking over, and even our famous Walt Whitman, who he was a nativist, you know, and he loved people, and his poetry shows that, and the diversity of New York, but he wrote disparaging things about the Irish in general and about immigrants.
And we're speaking with Cynthia Neal about her novel of a young Irish woman in America. It's called Nora, The Making of an Irish-American Woman in 19th Century New York. So Nora comes, she's, as this novel opens, she's kind of begun making good for herself to some degree. She's been able to scrape together enough money to open a dress shop, which she does with her friend Mary, and then her life changes. Give us a sense of what's going on here.
Well, she's excited, she's headstrong, she's feisty, she's, you know, she loves being in her Irish skin as much as she hates it. She ends up getting attacked by a police commissioner because she and Mary, they buy used clothing from the mission ladies who go into Cat's Hollow, which was an area of prostitution, and they buy from the prostitutes, they buy these dresses and spruce them up, and they sell them in her shop. And so there is a prostitute who is murdered, and so she's called in for questioning, and when she does, she's attacked. And it was an attempted rape, and she gets out of it. She flees. She's somehow... she's changed from that experience. she meets a newspaperman who is an Irish-American. He wasn't born in Ireland. He's born in this country, but his parents are born in Ireland. And he's come up in the world a bit. But his paper, there were so many newspapers during this period of time. And his paper is moderate. He wants to pull the Irish up to better standing in society, but he does so by the poetry and what Irishmen made good and opened a saloon, and he stays away from what's going on at Tammany Hall and from real extreme issues. But he
Tammany Hall? Some of our listeners may not know what that is. Yeah, so locate him. Politically, he's trying to kind of soft-pedal thing. He doesn't get into anything controversial. Like Tammany Hall, this was kind of the political machine in New York.
It was the political machine at the time, and later Boss Tweed, and it was a way for the Irishman to really get a strong arm and to bring himself up to get a job. I mean, there was corruption, but you give me my vote, and I'll give you a street cleaning job or a shop job or what have you. So it was I Gangs of New York. There's in that movie, it talks a lot about Tammany Hall and what went on, but there were ward healers and there was a lot of corruption. But it really was, it gave the Irish a voice, and it was their way of getting, climbing up, and they did pretty quickly. But she does work for the paper a bit, but she finally does her first article because. She does her first interview and article. She goes to visit the priest because he's taken an unusual stance as a Catholic priest.
And give us, he's an abolitionist.
Yes.
Is this something that you discovered through your research? I mean, were there priests who were involved in the abolition movement since it was so much of it in this country was Protestant evangelicalism that was behind the abolition movement?
He was unique. There weren't too many of them at the time, not that I know of, but in my research I found this priest and I was fascinated with him. He was, he had been in South America, and he was quite liberal, part of what would be liberation theology. And so this character is actually based on a real priest. I just changed his name. And he is taking a stand against slavery. And so Nora interviews him, and she writes up an article. And, of course, she's green. She doesn't really know how to write yet. She needs to learn. And the editor of the paper, the owner of the paper, Harrigan, he just sees something special in her. And so he is willing to work with her, but when he tries to correct her, she leaves in a fury. She just thought her words were just perfect and wonderful and didn't need any correcting. And so that's when she meets this Murray. But I don't want to give too much of it away.
Yeah, don't give it away. But instead, she does meet this man and she falls in love with him. So we won't go into the plot of this, but you do bring in, through this character of Mr. Murray, you bring in the Irish Rebellion going on, obviously, in Ireland, and the connections to here. What was going on at that time? I mean, I think a lot of us think of the 1920s, maybe, but this is a much earlier time. I didn't even know there was an Irish rebellion going on.
Well, certainly in Ireland there had been for a time, and then even after, but there was a period of time in Ireland, certainly after the Great Hunger, that there was little that was going on because, they were recovering. They were trying to recover, and then there were so many who left and so many who had died. And there was a movement called the Young Ireland Movement that had split off with Daniel O'Connell in his movement. And he was more of, no bloodshed and a peacemaker, and these big mass meetings they wanted to have, home rule. They really wanted to be a country in and of itself. So the Young Ireland Movement, they were more militant, and there were Protestants and Catholics involved in this movement. But of course, after the Great Hunger, it was just failing. There was one uprising, and it was laughable at the time because it was known as Widow McCormick's Uprising, and it failed. And then some of these these rebels were sent over to Tasmania. They were sent over to Australia. And one of them was John Mitchell, and he left. He was able to escape the prison there, and he got himself over to New York City. And so he was active in New York City. He was actually more active later than my setting, but I just moved it up a few years. And in my research, I found out not was he only, and it wasn't called the Young Ireland Movement. It was actually called, I believe, the Irish Brotherhood, and then eventually the Fenians. But I found that there were so many rebel groups there. The Fenians, there were the Fenian Sisterhood even, the Daughters of Erin, there were Lady Auxiliaries. And they were, you know, a lot of these groups are under the guise of being benevolent organizations, benevolent societies. And they certainly were helping the Irish who were coming over at the time and also sending money to Ireland. But there were factions that were involved in raising money to fight for freedom.
It almost reminds me of, Hamas or some of the other, you know, some of the organizations that are fighting for, against the Israeli occupation of Palestine, you know, that are social service organizations and then become political organizations and are also have a political or even an armed wing. Is that the kind of thing you think we can make a comparison?
I think so. But again, not all of these societies and these rebel societies were involved in the shedding of blood, and they were against that. But there were certainly many of them that were. And Nora's father is against the shedding of blood, you know, for freedom for Ireland. But she does involve herself with this man whose parents really raised him on this rebel juice and took him back over, back and forth, and were involved. So there is, yes, I do think it is. And I think that they looked at, you know, the history of America and just the fight against England and then our becoming a country and having hope at the time, you know, that they too could do it. But, you know, I don't know. You can do some comparison and you can't, you know, because it's unique in and of itself. But which ones were, I know certain ones that the Fenians were really involved in raising arms. But I did read that in my research, I found out that there was actually $30,000 or $40,000 raised to fight the British during this time period. Now, that's a lot of money for that time period.
From New York, you mean?
From New York, yes. But there was so much going on, and you know, we think Civil War, but this post massive immigration period and pre-Civil War is just, there's so much history there.
Yeah, and you have done an amazing job, Cynthia Neal, in this novel, Nora. You know, it just, the period and even the language, it just comes alive off the page. One feels that one is really right there. You know, I wanted to ask you, I mean, there was an awful lot of prejudice against the Irish. Why against, I mean, was it more against the Irish than it was against other immigrants? And if so, why?
Well, they were very different, the language, and you know, many of them did not speak English at the time. Many did, of course, but I think also because of Catholicism, I think there was a fear that there was this, maybe the first conspiracy theory, you know, that the Catholics are going to take over the world. There was that aspect. There was just the difference, you know, because, you know, they sent money over, Boston, New York, some of these cities, they sent money over to help. But when they started teaming in, 5,000 ships arrived in New York in 6 years, from 1845 to 1848 or so, 300 each day during the worst years in New York City. So, you know, you can have these ideals, and you can have all these mission societies, and you know, they're going to help these poor people. But when you have that many people coming that impoverished and so different in language and their lives, you know, and how they had lived, there was fear. There's always fear involved in that.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Cynthia Neal about her novel, Nora, The Making of an Irish-American Woman in 19th Century New York. Neal says the prejudice against the Irish followed them from England to America.
And then 1845, 1850, in Punch magazine or in the London Times. Well, in the London Times, it was said an Irishman in Connemara will soon be as rare a sight as a red Indian on the shores of Manhattan.
Oh, my goodness.
And in one of the diarists, Templeton Strong, I think his name was, he wrote in the Sun magazine, I think it was right around the sending of my novel in 1856, he said, America would become a great country if every Irishman would kill an African and be hung for it.
Oh, God.
And I, you know, when I speak, I go to libraries, I go to writers' groups, I speak at different places, and I tell people this, and they can't believe it, that this was said, but it was said, and it was believed. And they portrayed them as monkeys in the political cartoons.
And then, so, on another tack then, you know, it seems that the Irish have become, you know, we're airing this for St. Patrick's Day. I can't think of another ethnic festival that is celebrated by so many people who do not belong to that ethnicity as St. Patrick's Day.
I know.
Why do you think it's so captured the imagination of the American people?
Oh, again, I think that spirit of that indomitable spirit, that the triumph, you know, and just the gift that the Irish people have given to the world, and especially this country, so many Irish people here, and everyone wants to claim Irish blood, but that no Irish need apply wasn't that long ago, was it?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that just the pride and still being, I think they assimilated really well. I mean, you hear long ago, you know, there was the lace curtain Irish, they and the shanty Irish, and the shanty Irish just were going to stay in their own enclaves, and they're going to be Irish no matter what. And then the lace curtain Irish, they were going to forget their Irish. They're going to get rid of their, that they came from Ireland. They're going to get rid of their brogue, and they just want to assimilate, and that's it. But I think what's happened is there's been such a beautiful assimilation now, where there's this celebration of being Irish, but you're American, and being able to marry that well now in over a number of years.
Neil says the Irish have always had a great pride in themselves that allowed them to survive in their new land.
So I don't think they ever, no matter how downtrodden they were, did they really lose that pride and that love of their country.
Mm, wonderful. Well, the book is Nora, The Making of an Irish-American Woman in 19th Century New York. It's a fascinating read. Thanks so much, Cynthia Neal, for speaking with us here.
Thank you.
Cynthia Neal is the author of two previous novels about Nora McCabe, both for older children. They are The Irish Dresser and Hope in New York City. Nora is being released March 19th. Next up, we talk with Kevin O'Hara about his memoir of being an Irish immigrant in America. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We first spoke to Kevin O'Hara in 2005 about his memoir, The Last of the Donkey Pilgrims. That book was about his circumambulation of Ireland on the back of a donkey. His new memoir, A Lucky Irish Lad, recounts his life as an immigrant coming to America at the tender age of 4 from England. That's where his parents had first emigrated to find work during the Great Depression years of the 1930s. But England was only a stepping stone to the hope of a better life in America. The O'Hara family settled in the town of Pittsfield in western Massachusetts. Kevin O'Hara tells a story in A Lucky Irish Lad.
Yeah, A Lucky Irish Lad. It's from birth in England, emigrating over to America with our family, of course, my parents, with five children in tow, and then grown up, and it ends when I come home from Vietnam. So it's my first 21 years of life. We were always a little out of step because my parents were both Irish-born, Roscommon and Longford. So we were oddballs in the community, to say the least.
Oddballs. Were you the only Irish immigrants to be in Pittsfield?
No, but my parents were, they were like just really off the boat, so to speak. And they had five children off the boat. However, we were born in England.
So your parents were both Irish, but they met in England. Tell us about that. What were they doing there?
Well, it was the 1930s, of course, and there wasn't very much for either of them in Ireland. I mean, Ireland was, I mean, they were having trouble here in this country in the 30s, so you can imagine what it was like there. My father was the youngest of the family, therefore he wouldn't have been given the farm that would have gone to his older brother, my Uncle Mickey. And so he emigrated to England, and my mother, whose sister before her was accepted into a nursing school in Northampton, England, my mother got her letter of acceptance. She was 17 years of age, and she was saving hay barefoot in a field when her letter came. 3 days later, she found herself in the wards of a psychiatric unit at St. Andrew's Hospital.
And you yourself are now a psychiatric nurse, is that right?
Yeah, I just retired. I retired at the young age of 61.7 years of age.
a lucky Irish lad indeed.
Oh, how about it? And then, yeah, and then my mom and dad, they met at a dance in Northampton. There was a cathedral there, and there was a dance, and my dad and mom fell in love with each other, married, had five of us children. And then my dad and mom, who both felt the pains of emigration, seeing their own siblings scattered to the four winds, decided to beat us to the punch. And Dad said to Mom, let's emigrate to America. Then when they grow up, they'll stay put, you know, as opposed to coming to America and leaving them in either England or Ireland.
And your dad was warned not to go to America by relatives that already were here. Why was that? And why did he choose to ignore it?
Well, he ignored it a little too late. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was already on the boat, basically, and the letter was crumbled up. So he really never saw the letter until he arrived here in America. And by then, we didn't have enough money to seek passage back, although my mother sent queries hoping to do so. We took the Queen Elizabeth, the Cunard Line, and when we did arrive in New York, we had my dad had $220 in his pocket. So it was a tough old go. So we stayed with his sister living in New York, and eventually we moved up to live near my mother's sister, who settled in Lenox, Massachusetts. And therefore, Pittsfield is only 10, 12 miles away, and we settled in Pittsfield eventually.
Now, it was a real hard move on your mother.
Yeah, very much so. And I think, you know, there's always these defining incidences in life, and I really think her particular homesickness eventually brought on my donkey travel so many years later. She suffered from very low periods. Now, she could have had postpartum depression because, you know, we had three more. They had three more children when we arrived in America. Five wasn't quite enough, so they added three more that we used to always kiddingly call the Yanks. But with the birth of two of them, she did end up in a hospital on both occasions and really wasn't able to take care of the children for some time. And she started saving her dimes to go back to Ireland in a Skippy jar. And this went on for 14 years. And after 14 years, she had enough for passage for herself, my dad, my brother Dermot, and I. We were the lucky recipients. And we went to Ireland in 1967. And it was just that she had to touch base, just had to go there, see it again, breathe it again, and live it and see the people that she had left behind. And after those 3 weeks, she came back to America, and she never suffered from homesickness again or any form of depression. It was like it just lifted from her, and it was fairly remarkable. I oftentimes say she was like Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music, running over the hills, in comparison to how she was here, a dour housewife, a mother of eight, you know, living in a duplex, a drafty duplex on Wilson Street.
And for you, going to Ireland that first time, though, wasn't such a happy occasion. You had some real culture shock.
Well, first of all, the bathroom was one item, but, we were boys and kind of got away with it a little bit.
But, the bathroom? You have to explain.
Yeah, there was no jacks at all, Actually, where we used to go, my brother Dermot and I, we were always like the Hardy Boys, Frank and Joe. We always felt there was an adventure at the crest of the hill. But either way, we had our little spot. Come to find out, it was where my great-grandmother was born, so we were soiling up the hearth there, unbeknownst to us. It was just an old ruin in the back fields. But it was also the food. I mean, they all had cornflakes. And cornflakes are very nice, especially the cornflakes in Ireland. They taste a whole lot better. But it would be topped with this lumpy, yellowish milk that was much the same consistency as gravy to us. And
fresh from the cow.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, we were spoiled little Yanks by that time. You know what I mean? We were 18 and 16 years of age, and we didn't care for too much of it. Plus, we couldn't make heads or tails out of what our uncles were always talking about. And then they took us in their automobile and fixed us properly by standing us a couple of pints at Radigan's Pub. And, we had one pint, and we thought it was some type of initiation that after we had our pint, we'd be given a sash or a medal to show our friends back home. But sure enough, bingo, bango, bongo, another pint showed up in front of us, and we were absolutely waxed. Actually, we were carried out of Radigan's Pub. That was our baptism into the wilds of the Celtic world.
And you did go back another time, too. So back to Pittsfield, there you were with your, with your siblings and your mom and dad. I get the sense that it was hard on your dad as well, and that in some way he took his solace from religion. I mean, I think your parents, all of you seem to have, but he had you in the living room doing Hail Marys at the drop of a hat. It was a bit onerous and something that, do you think it had something to do with immigration?
It may have, but, the Irish, especially in Ireland at that time, his growing up, he had a very deep faith. And his two jobs, I mean, he was offered jobs. Pittsfield was a GE town, when he came. But I tell you what, he would not have factory work. His first job was a janitor at St. Charles, the school, the church, the rectory. And he was also the bell ringer there. And that pleased him to no end to be the bell ringer. In fact, after he left as janitor at St. Charles, he continued to ring the bell for many years. And he was good at bell ringing. And then after his janitorial stint, he took a job as a chauffeur for the Sisters of Providence at St. Luke's Hospital here in Pittsfield. So he was always very close to the church, even in his vocations. In fact, the nuns, he drove around in this big Fleetwood Cadillac, a seven-passenger Cadillac, and the nuns almost saw him as a Monsignor driving around because he'd even lead them in the rosary coming home on the turnpike after a trip to the mother house or the gray house and such things. And we were a very poor family in our parish, and it would embarrass us to no end because we spent a lot of our time driving around in that Cadillac, because my father had the use of it on weekends. And then about, you were saying, vacations. That was killing because everybody else went to Storytown or Frontierland or Howe Caverns or Riverside Park. And then here we go to Orrisville, to the Shrine of the North American Martyrs or St. Joseph's Oratory up in Montreal. And these kids, they'd come, say, from Frontierland, and they'd have Davy Crockett hats and rifles and things. And the only thing I remember bringing back from our little pilgrimages, our junkets, was a play camera. that clicked the five joyful mysteries. It just didn't have the same impact, you know, as a little 22 or cork gun, you know. But that's what I was telling you earlier, how we were always out of step. And saying the rosary every night, which you didn't mind because it was just what we did. And it was fine in the winter. My father said the Hails and we said the Holies, and you really had to keep on the ball. Because, you know, you'd lull to sleep with the mantra of the prayer, more or less. And plus, you had a million other things on your mind. And he'd stop suddenly dead. And then he'd ask us how many Hail Marys were left in that particular decade of 10. You know, and he'd hide his beads. And boy, I tell you what, if you weren't right, he'd give you the boot up to behind. You'd run up the stairs because you knew it was coming. And he'd carry you three steps further with his shoe that got you right in the arse as you ran up the stairs, and you would not come down until the next morning.
Well, you know, when I was reading that, I was kind of wondering, you treat it kind of lightly, but how scary was this?
Well, you know what? It's really funny. I don't know. We, as a family, when we get together, and it's great, I mean, we always had this lovely, well, you know, our front room on Wilson Street was, I mean, you'd almost genuflect going into it. There were so many religious pictures and icons. But there was one, the family that, you know, prays together, stays together, which is a well-known phrase. Mm-hmm. Well, when we eight get together, and we oftentimes do because we're very still a great, tightly knit family, we laugh our heads off at these stories. We find them to be the most comical. And if nothing else, despite the fact that it was maybe a bit of a hard go then, my father left us a great legacy in leaving us good stories to tell. Mm-hmm. I mean, how would I ever, you know, filled up a lucky Irish lad if I didn't have crazy little tales to tell?
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Kevin O'Hara about his memoir of growing up as an Irish immigrant to Western Massachusetts in the 1950s and 60s. He says he often felt like an alien from another planet. The family was very poor, very devout, and had one foot in the new country and one foot in the old.
Mom would have us wear on St. Patrick's Day shamrock, real shamrock that her mother would send. It would come in little envelopes, you know, and with foil. And she'd make me wear this little tiny bouquet on my shirt very proudly. And, oh, it killed me. I mean, the kids in school call me St. Kevin of the Sissies, you know, because, I mean, it was the worst thing in the world you could do. But, again, it left us with stories. And at the end of the day, to me, that's what it's all about.
So you wanted to fit in. Of course, you became a Yank. You became an American boy. You wanted to join the Little League. And it was a tough thing. And you kept on trying out and kept on being denied. And then you found out why.
Yeah, I did. And I failed in my three attempts. And my final attempt, I actually made it. And there were a couple of reasons why. I wasn't a bad little ball player, but I didn't have the outfit. I mean, you know, when you should try out for the Little League, first of all, there were hundreds of kids back then. And it seemed like every coach worked at the GE. And since it was such a GE town, you know, I mean, the shop steward would have a couple of kids going out, you know, and sure enough, the coach would choose him, you know, and pick him out. And, you know, the year I actually made it is a big thing happened in the Irish community, and that was really when JFK became president. And it was a startling event because I remember my mom, first of all, the first time I ever went downstairs in the morning to find her sleeping on the couch with the television set still on. She had watched the elections into the night, and there was still no decision until the next day. And I remember my dad coming home after, and, you know, that same afternoon, the next afternoon, and he was so proud. He walked like a little peacock around the house because John Kennedy had become the president. And in certain ways, I think all the immigrants for the couple of hundred years coming to America paved the way in many ways for JFK. And it was that same time that I, too, felt like I was less, and I could imagine what the black folk in America feel about Barack Obama and how absolutely proud they are and you know how they've arrived finally. And that's the way we felt in the same way. And believe me, that next spring, it was when I made the Little League. And so maybe the O in O'Hara was no longer No'Hara, but O'Hara.
Mm. Well, let's move on a little bit, and we're going to kind of skip over your teenage years, although there's a lot in there, and it's really a wonderfully told tale. I'd like to talk about Vietnam, because you ended up, well, your older brother went to Vietnam and came back, and then you did as well. So tell us what happened. What were you doing there?
Well, I was fairly fortunate there. I was a crash rescue firefighter. Which I was in the Air Force, which meant I was at an air base. I was at Cameron Bay. And basically our job was, as a fireman, firefighter, was when an aircraft came down, say without wheels or, you know, low on fuel, a hydraulic problem or something, we would roll with them, hoping that they didn't crash. And very few did crash, so we were very fortunate about that. But it was just... I used to get down to Tan Sanu, which was in Saigon, where I had a good friend. And there's where I really became involved with photography and actually writing for the first time because I wanted to be a photojournalist, you know, and I used to see all the journalists. And there was a hotel, I believe, called the Ambassador Hotel, and they'd all hang out with their Nikon cameras and their khaki outfits. And I found that to be so romantic because Saigon really was and was considered a Paris of the Orient with their wide boulevards. But then I saw the absolute poverty of it all and, of course, all the displacement, the refugees. And I used to start taking photographs of that, you know, and, of course, it would bother you. But it just gave you a sense at age 19 that the world wasn't spinning in the way that you would hope that it was spinning. I mean, you'd see like a little newspaper boy without legs and things, and you'd just be stopped dead in your tracks, or somebody burnt with napalm and disfigured, and you say, oh, my God, this is all wrong. And then more so, you'd see young girls who are forced into prostitution and massage bars, and, you know, you say, you know, geez, this is pretty ugly stuff.
In fact, your photography friend, when you first went out with him, you were about to go into one of those massage places, and he stopped you. What did he say to you?
He pulled me back. He said, you know, we had a couple of 33 beers. That's the French, you know, French beer. And, you know, of course, I was frisky. I felt like Marco Polo, too. You know, I mean, there was one side of me who knew what was right and another side who didn't care, you know. So in a fevered pitch, I went towards the door, and he said, well, take a picture beforehand and see how proud you'll be in the morning. And when you talk about defining moments in your life, I mean, that was certainly one of them. So I declined, and I went back with him. I caught up to him. And he was very, very proud of my decision.
Mm. And then you actually fell in love with a Vietnamese tea girl, a kind of platonic relationship. Her name was Thu Yet, is that right?
That was difficult for me because, again, I felt for her plight. It would be hard to say if I was actually in love, but I just really... I felt for her, and I felt for her more of just all she had gone through and what she'd have to go through, and that was tough. And we sent many letters back and forth a year or so later, and my goal was to get back there somehow. I wanted to become a nurse and join the Tom Dooley Foundation, get back to Laos or Cambodia where Dr. Tom Dooley had these clinics, and eventually paved my way into Saigon and marry her. That was my headset when I came home from Vietnam. And in fact, looking back, it was misdirected in certain ways. But I started nursing school, but unfortunately, the war poured into Laos and Cambodia, and therefore Dr. Tom Dooley's clinics were basically abandoned or shifted. And then I got a letter from Thu Yet, and she said she was happy now, and that she had hoped I was happy too. And I felt really, it should have broken my heart, but it was absolutely relieved. And I felt at that moment, and there was a pansy, like a dried pansy, in the actual letter. And when I got that letter, I just felt the war was finally over for me. You know, it put a close to it, and I could move on because I was stuck there, you know.
Well, you say something in the book, A Lucky Irish Lad, Kevin O'Hara, in your book, when you came back, you didn't really go into it. You say something that you wanted to right a wrong by going back, by working with Tom Dooley, and maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what that was about. But you don't say much about what you felt was wrong. I mean, when you were in Vietnam, what were you feeling about the war?
Yeah, well, first of all, when I did go, see, you never know. You know, people say to me years after, why weren't you a conscientious objector? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I could have been one at the particular time because I had never witnessed war. Many times we'd have to stand by as firefighters when the air vacs would fill up with our own wounded, you know. And there were times when the North Vietnamese prisoners would be lined up on the flight line, and we'd spray them down, you know, nicely, you know, because they'd be out there for hours.
Spray them down? You mean with water?
Yeah, with water, just to keep them cool.
Mm-hmm.
And some were kids. I mean, some were like little league age. You know, those kind of things. And then you felt bad of just being a participant. Regardless of what you did there, for me anyways, it was being a participant. And if I wasn't there, somebody would have taken my place, sure, but I should have been doing better things. I should have been mending things as opposed to, you know, the other end of it causing the wound, even though I was only a backup. And believe me, I go into any cockpit to pull a pilot out for certain. That wasn't it. It was just not wishing in some ways to be there. And I always felt the right or wrong was that that was a negative in me, that I had been thrown out some, you know, poor karma over the years. And for me to fix that was to go back and help with the orphans there. And that's what Dr. Tom Dooley did.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, this philosophy was very hazy at the time, and it probably still is. It was just a troubling time for me, and it probably still is a wee bit, you know.
There, in fact, there's a moment, one of the first Vietnamese women with whom you made friends, and I mean friends, not a sexual relationship, was a woman named Phuong, or if I'm pronouncing that correct.
Yeah, Phuong.
Phuong. And yeah. She had a disfigured cheek, but you don't really elaborate on that. You say something that she had gotten a rifle butt in the face when she tried to give a North Vietnamese prisoner some water. I mean, I assume that came from an American soldier. Is that right?
It could have been, but it could have been a South Vietnamese soldier, too. Mm-hmm. They were on the watch, watching the prisoners before they were sent to Long Binh jail, but it wouldn't be Long Binh either. Well, it could well have been, but they were certainly going south. Cameron Bay was a collecting point for many things. It was a major base right in the middle of the country along the sea, so we had a lot of comings and goings. But she was certainly instrumental. In fact, she kicked the ball into play for me because I got into this MedCap team. The beauty of my job was that I'd worked many days in a row, and then I'd have so many off, and I was allowed to do these things. And this was the MedCap team, and you could actually leave the base and go out to, you know, villages nearby and assist. And she was basically our guide and nurse, who would see us from village to village and point to the doctor who needed help and what could be done. And I also, at that same time, I read The Night They Burned the Mountain by Dr. Tom Dooley. That's when all things came together, that this was what I was hoping to do when I returned home.
And you have. You spent how many years? 35 years? Something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah. As a psychiatric nurse, yes.
Right.
On and off, but basically 30 for certain.
Did you have an opportunity to work with vets ever, Vietnam vets?
Yes, but only if they came in to our facility. There weren't so many. I do remember a few, and I would be assigned to them, which I would like to do. But I think now there's going to be a great outpouring of new veterans coming in. There was a chance that I could have gone to the old soldiers' home, which is in Holyoke, Mass. But see, where I worked as a psych unit, I live a mile away from it. I became very comfortable there. I started my orderly days there and going through nursing school. We did our clinical there. So it was a natural fit for me to stay at Berkshire Medical Center. And then I met my dear wife there as well. She was a medical technologist training from the Philippine Islands. She was fresh from the Philippines and taking this lab internship. And I fell in love with her. And in many ways, too, that completed the full circle that I married an Asian woman. And we're very happy together. We have two sons. But it also settled me a little bit in far as regards of me ever returning to Southeast Asia.
So do you have any last things to say about being an Irish immigrant? Of course, you came as a very young child. Were you about 3 years old when you came?
Four. Yeah, I was 4 years of age, yeah.
Do you remember England at all?
I do. There's little scraps of it, I do. And I had a little red gun that clicked. I remember that vividly. I remember there was a fire across the street from where we lived once, and of course my parents knew of it as well. And I remember crossing the Queen, and we were given these little bouncing balls, and we were up quite high, and I bounced the ball maybe three times, and it went over the rails and into the water, and of course I cried my eyes out. You know, it was a lovely little ball. An odd thing to give, by the way, to a child, you know, on a boat. And my brother said to me, here, and he gave me a bunch of grapes. And we started throwing down one grape at a time at the tugboats that were pulling us out of Southampton, England. And I found that great fun being a little bombardier, right? And, yeah, that was very, very vivid. And I remember this little teddy bear I kept on my sweater that my mother would pin on my sweater. And that's all at age 3 and 3 and a half, and coming on to 4 years of age.
Hmm. Well, the memoir is A Lucky Irish Lad. We've been speaking with Kevin O'Hara about it. It's his second memoir. The first was Last of the Donkey Pilgrims, which was about a trip he took to Ireland. We've spoken to him about that before. Thanks so much, Kevin, for speaking with us here.
Oh, thanks a million for having me again.
Kevin O'Hara is writing a third memoir about his life as a psychiatric nurse. And finally, we didn't get a chance to interview Alfie McCourt about his latest piece, just out for St. Patrick's Day. It's called St. Patrick, the Banner, the Hat, and the FBI. We spoke with McCourt several years ago about his memoir, A Long Stone's Throw. He's also the youngest brother of Frank McCourt, author of the memoir Angela's Ashes. Alfie McCourt's new story strings together retellings of a few of the expatriate Irishman's most memorable St. Patrick days here in the U.S. You can find a link to the author reading the piece at writersvoice.net, and you can also read the piece for yourself. And by the way, don't forget that you can always listen to Writer's Voice anytime you want. Just subscribe to our free podcast at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.